Up. Yesterday, or in the first session of this series, we reached chapter 2 and verse 4 of Habakkuk. If you have an outline, you might find that in your outline. If you want to use the outline, fine. And while you're turning to Habakkuk 2 and verse 4, I'd like to summarize what we have covered so far. The book of Habakkuk records a dialogue that rises out of Habakkuk's difficulty in the circumstance in which he finds himself. He cannot reconcile his experience and the circumstance of his day with his theology. And so the book opens with Habakkuk questioning God directly about God's seeming indifference to the evil, violence, aggression, injustice, and strife that was prevalent in Judah. And we said one of the reasons for that prevalence was the apostasy of Judah and its decline in its turning its back on God's institutions. In answering that question, God said that he was even then raising up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, to put down Israel, at which time there was only Judah left, with even greater violence. This only stirred up more questions in Habakkuk's mind. And so in his second request, he responds with more questions. And these could be summarized something like this. Would you, O holy God, use the unrighteous to punish the righteous? You see, Habakkuk understood that believers could sin. But this did not alter their righteous position before God, because righteousness was imputed because of their faith in the sacrificial system at that time, which looked forward to Jesus Christ. Now we look back to the death of Jesus Christ and his righteousness is imputed to us. And Habakkuk knew that believers could sin, but in their position, identity in God, they were still righteous because they had the imputed righteousness of deity. And so he says, how could you use the unrighteous to punish the righteous, even though these righteous ones were living in violence and degeneration and so on? And he says, if you will use that, for how long will you let the righteous go, seeing their lust for power and dominion is insatiable? Okay? Now, in response to that, God's second answer came in verse 2, and let's read it as sort of a review. And God, or then the Lord answered me and said, write the vision, make it plain upon the tables. The writing is there is going to be objective revelation information. It's going to be written. It's going to be clear. The purpose of that is so that he that readeth, he may run that readeth it. And the idea is of urgency of getting out the message. Reason. For the vision is yet for an appointed time. But at the end it shall speak and not lie. In other words, whatever I give you as a vision, that will be reality. That will be truth. And though it hasn't happened yet, you can depend on what I tell you to be reality. Reality will always conform to the truth of the Word of God. And so what God is encouraging him to do is have trust in this vision and what he's going to tell him. Though it tarry, wait for it, verse 3, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. Behold, his soul is lifted up. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him. In other words, the proud person, in this case the Chaldean, but it's true of any proud person, because of his pride, his soul is out of whack. Now the heart of Habakkuk is in the next clause, and the idea would be like this, but in the meantime, the just one the righteous one, that is, the one who has this imputed righteousness which Habakkuk has already referred to, that one will live not simply by faith, but by, notice the personal pronoun, by his faith. We could translate it this way. The justified one will live by his faith. The righteous one, the one that God perceives as being just or righteous before himself because he has been saved, we could say, shall live by his faith. Now, the first thing I would like to do tonight is to work on this, the words in the Old Testament, five words in the Old Testament for faith. And we're going to take the first one, which is in this passage. This is five Old Testament words for faith. And the Hebrew words are full of imagery. And the imagery that these connotate should give us some idea of what the Old Testament talks about when it talks about faith. Faith is a key word, and the salvation promises of redemption, both in the Old and New Testament, are always have one prerequisite, and that is faith. The first word that we want to look at is the word aman. Aman. If anyone writes in Hebrew, and I don't think there is, but there may be, we'll just put it up here in Hebrew. The rest of you, don't worry about it. It's like Amman, which is the capital of what country? Jordan. That word is a key word for faith. Now, this is a verb. This is a verb. And if you are looking at a Hebrew text of Habakkuk 4, you'll find the cognate noun of this, which is emunah, and I'll just put it up here like this. Emunah, this is Habakkuk 4, Habakkuk 2, verse 4. It is the noun form. Now, aman is the most common word for faith in the Old Testament. And what aman really means is to prop or support oneself on someone or something. To prop or support someone on something. Now, implied in that is the sense of need. A beginning skier in Colorado in 90, I was on Loveland Pass skiing, and it was the first run of the morning, and some bozo who didn't know how to ski and was out of control came down the mountain. We were only two of us on the whole mountain. And I'm doing little stem Christies. I'm not even going, you know, a big wide turn. I'm just doing little stem Christies, and this guy comes, boom, right into this left ankle. Cuts the boot almost in half, breaks my ankle on both sides, tears out all the ligaments in both legs. I had great need of a prop, a support. I sensed my need of a prop and a support. I received the prop and support, and I leaned on the prop and support for probably, I don't remember, 3 months, I don't know, you know, hip cast for 6 weeks, boot cap for three, boot, yeah, you know. In other words, implied in this is the sense of need. Now, this is the word that you find in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 5 and 6, where it says, "And Abraham believed God, and it was counted for him for righteousness." The word counted there means it was imputed or put to his account for righteousness. And Paul will use this belief of Abraham to show that Abraham had the imputed righteousness of deity before he was circumcised. He'll do that in Romans 4 to prove that circumcision had nothing to do with Abraham's salvation or anybody else's in the Old Testament. As human beings, we have the greatest way of getting things out of whack. God gave the rite of circumcision as a mark of the flesh to show that the Jewish male was under the covenant of Abraham. It was just a mark in the flesh to show that they were covenant related to God. And by the time you get to Jesus Christ, it becomes part of the plan of salvation. And we laugh about it. And by the time you get to the 3rd century, they have water baptism as a plan of salvation, as part of the plan of salvation. And you got churches all around here today teaching that if you don't get baptized, you're not saved. Well, you can get baptized though every fish in the brook calls you by your first name, and it has absolutely nothing to do with your salvation. As human beings, we have a great knack of getting things screwed up. And Paul says, when he's making his appeal to the Jewish mind, he says, when was Abraham saved? Before he was circumcised or after? And he uses this verse as proof for that. So our first word is that faith is something that looks to something as a prop or support, and here he looked to God. And the implication is that he looked to God in saving faith, what God had provided. From this we could gather a basic definition. I won't take time to put it up here, but faith is simply believing truth. Faith is simply believing truth. The context will inevitably, whenever aman is used, the context will evident will explain what the something or someone is. Always. Faith is simply believing truth. Therefore, in order to have faith, we must have something to believe or something to prop ourselves on. Moreover, there is a felt need for the support that we're going to believe. Prerequisite to believing something is truth in which to put our faith. Therefore, we do not pray for faith. We pray for truth so that we might believe it. I have a series, I think, of 8 points on faith, but somehow I want to get into this this series that we're having here, and we'll do it sometime, even if I have to keep you till midnight. And by the way, I don't mind people looking at their watches, but in one service I saw a man unroll a calendar. You heard about the guy that for the first time came into church and sat in the back, and boy, the pastor just went on and on and on. So he had never been there before, and he nudged the person next to him. He says, how long has this guy been preaching? And the guy says, about 10 years. The guy says, wow, I'll give him about 10 more minutes. He ought to be finished any time along the way here. So there's two key questions when you see the word faith or trust. You want to ask yourself, in whom or in what? And how that faith relates to the object. And you will find that you always have this continual relation that God is aman, he is trustworthy. The second word that is used in the Old Testament for faith is the word batak. B-A-T-A-C-H. Ba-tach. All Hebrew verbs have 3 letters. And when I studied, you would probably do better than I assure you. I'm just a plodder. I have to plod through things. And I just keep plodding and plodding and plodding. But boy, after you learn about 100 Hebrew verbs and they're all 3 letters, 3 consonants. They all run together. Well, that's the way this word. Now, what this means is, this is a verb that means to throw on one's face. I don't mean like you throw a cup of water or something. It means you throw yourself on your face. To throw, and I'm going to abbreviate this, on one's face. You prostrate yourself, in other words, or to lie extended. To prostrate yourself on the ground. And the flavor of this word is illustrated by the fact that it is always exercised under pressure. Or it is a verb that indicates that there'll probably be some situation in which you will be prone to do that, so that you are at rest. The idea is to be at rest and trusting. At rest and trusting. Now you'll find this in the 37th Psalm and verse 5, which you probably many of you have remembered. It reads this way: commit thy way unto the Lord. Commit thy way. That is, you know, where am I going? How am I going to get there? Or I am doing this, Lord. You know that I'm doing this. This is my way. Then it says, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. Here the object of your complete thrusting of yourself upon the Lord has to do with some situation of stress in which you find yourself, and you commit it to the Lord, and you trust in him, and he'll bring the situation to pass. Boy. When I first went into Christian work, I got involved with a group. I won't mention any names. They were fundamentalists. They were Bible-believing. And they were very emotional. And they would have altar calls. And I noticed the same person's nearly... church said 1,000. I noticed that the same people went forward every time, and I thought, boy, something must be screwy in this place. Something's wrong. Well, I wasn't there about 6 months, and I decided if they did what they wanted to do and had the best school that they ever could have in the most farthest stretches of the imagination, I still didn't want to be involved in it. And so I began praying. You know how long it took? 4.5 years. I had great ministry there. I had a big Sunday school class. I taught adults. If they wanted a wedding, they asked me to do it. If they had a funeral, they wanted me to do it. I had radio ministry. I taught in a college. I wrote in a paper. I had all kinds, but I just kept praying. And finally I said, in 9 months, I'm leaving. I had no contacts. I had only in Christian work been with these people for 15 years. I got serious about the Lord's work. I went to their seminary, blah, 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 blah. I had no contacts. It was like you're just cut off. And I wouldn't tell anybody to do this, but this is the way I did it. I said, God, I don't need to write to the Evangelical Teacher Placement Service. Evangelical teacher, write your dossier out. You say, oh, I got this degree, I got that degree, I got this experience, I got that experience, I can teach this, I can teach that, and you give it to them, and they circulate it all over the country to all the evangelical places. I said, I don't need to do that. I don't think Paul would do that. I'm sort of real humbly comparing myself with Paul. But I was dead serious, honest. I said, if you can answer Paul's prayer, you can answer my prayer. And I'm going to wait. I don't want to open the door. I am going to wait. And I want to tell you, 6 months passed, 7 months passed. I took the family, we went camping in the Rocky Mountains. I walked, I fished, I fought, I prayed, I worried. I'm an expert worrier. I have a list of things to worry about. If anything happens, like tomorrow, it'll take 2 weeks for me to worry about it. My list is so long. My wife said I began to not sleep good. I got back from vacation, and a friend of mine says, did you hear about the need in this school? And I says, no, I don't even know that school. Where is it? Well, it's out here, you know, it's been out here for years. Dispensational, fundamental. And I says, well, I've been praying for three things. One, I want to continue my work on my PhD. Two, I have to support my family. I don't want to have to take an extra job. Three, I want to teach college kids. And he says, well, that's great. I made an appointment for you to go out there. He says, I thought where you were going. He says, I went out and talked to him about it. He says, I didn't want it. He says, I just told him about you. And he says, I didn't make an appointment. He says, I talked to him. He says, they're expecting you to call. I called him. I went out. And it was Western Bible College. And the man started talking to me. And he says, they told us you were working on graduate work. Yeah, he says, well, that's good. We'd like you to keep doing that, and we'd like to pay for it. Then he said, now, we want you to teach, of course. You have to teach a full load. And we want you to work with the students. We'll make you dean of students. And then he said, part of your remuneration is that you have to live here on campus. We'll pay you so much. Your whole family can move out here. And I didn't crack a smile or anything. I just said, that sounds very interesting. I got out and drove in the car and drove home, and I got out the end of the road, and I just stopped the car and shook my head. And I said to God, I would have to be the biggest hypocrite in the world if I didn't take this job. And I took it. See, this verb indicates some stress. And David in this case is telling us what to do to rest it on the Lord and trust Him, and He would bring it to pass. And I was at that school for 7 years and became the acting president of that college for 3 years. And probably would still be there if the Lord didn't cause some other things that happened to move me on to be a pastor. Old Testament concept for faith, we have two words. One has to do with a sense of prop and support, in which case you'd have a need. The other one had to do with a sense of stress. The third word is the word yahal. Yahal. Can I tell you another? Oh. For those of you, we have some young men here who are in the ministry. Let me tell you another, just an addendum to that, okay? I'm a cash person. I don't like debt. And I struggle to be out of debt. But there was a man in my class that formerly owned the biggest Buick dealership in Denver, downtown Buick. And when I met him, he had sold it. And he was sort of semi-retired, and he had an office across the street from where I... In fact, he had an office in the building where I edited the paper. And he was in my Sunday school class. He came all the time. And he was an older man. He was in his 70s. And he said on a Sunday, he says, hey, Ron, come in my office tomorrow. I want to talk to you about something. So when I went in and I sat down and he says, I know you're leaving and I'm going to miss you. I just want you to know how much I enjoyed your ministry. And he said, how much are you in debt? And I said, I don't even know. I said, it can't be much because I don't believe much. I don't believe in debt. I don't know. And he says, I want to pay all your bills. Wouldn't you like to go out there and not have a bill? Well, then my lust pattern flew into... I sort of said to myself, gee, I wish I'd bought a car a month ago or something like that. I went home and checked it out. It was about $550, so I went back and told him, he sat down and wrote a check for $900. I haven't ever seen him since. I'm sure he's gone now. The Lord can take care of you. You don't need denominations. You don't need machines. You do need God's people.
because that's what God has ordained in this age for the support of the ministry. But you don't need to go around begging God's people. Epitaph on a lot of our pastors' tombs could be, "And the beggar died also." Okay, Yahal. Looks like this in Hebrew. Oh, I'm sorry. Started writing in Hebrew and here. I only got the English up there. I'm sorry. Yahal means to be weak. In fact, it is from this stem that we get the word to be sick. And hence, it comes to mean to be dependent. To be dependent. And in that sense, then, excuse me, I have to keep the caps on these pens or they dry out. Hence, it means dependent or to wait patiently. The idea is to be pressed by external circumstance to such a degree that one's hope only is in God. And this is what you find in Job chapter 13 and verse 15 when Job says, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him." Now, by the time you get to Job 13, hey, he's in kind of sick shape, man. I mean, you know, he's already lost his family, all his kids. He's lost his property, his farm, his animals. He's lost his health. Then his wife says, you know, she was a real help, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" Then he had these three marvelous friends come along. And the essence of each one of them is, "What sin did you do to get in this shape, Job?" Job says, by the time he gets to chapter 13, "I'm in bad shape, but though the Lord slay me, yet will I serve him." And so the person is pressed by external circumstance to such a degree that he finds his only hope in God. And you know, when you get in those circumstances, it's extremely uncomfortable. But when you look back several years down the road, you thank the Lord for them and you say, "Yes, Peter, you're right. It was the trial of my faith that was more precious than of gold that perishes. It was a test of faith." If you say you are trusting God for something, then get ready for the test. He is not going to permit you as a believer to give lip service to faith. It's too important. So he's going to test you out to teach you whether you really are trusting in what you said. Get ready for the test. Too easy to put lip service to this. Point four. Hasa, hasa. You know, I did that backwards. I made it like a sigma. Gotcha. It's like this. Hasa. This means to flee for refuge. To flee for refuge. Like a mouse running from a cat. Like chicks to a mother hen. Or if you're out in the woods when a ruffed grouse or a pheasant has given birth and the little chicks are there and they hear you coming and the grouse will put on this act and flop its wings and act like it has a broken leg, and while you're watching the grouse, the little chicks are all going running under the leaves so you can't find them. And then about 15 minutes later, you hear the mother call them. And I've come these little beautiful little creatures with the big eyes, and they go over and crawl under the mother's wings. So is Hasa, Psalm chapter 36 and verse 7. "How excellent is thy loving kindness, O God. Therefore the children of men put their trust under the shadow of thy wings." Again, notice a sense of need that's implied in this. You are looking for refuge, you are looking for strength, and you look to the Lord. The fifth and last word that we want to show you relative to the Old Testament and faith is kawah. 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 Now, kawah means to twist, to turn, under tension. Therefore, a patient waiting under tension. Okay? All right, this one I want you to turn to. Keep Habakkuk where he is and turn over to Isaiah 40. You've memorized this verse. Isaiah 40 and verse 31. I'm going to read verse 30. It's a marvelous verse. If you haven't memorized this verse, by the way, you should memorize verse 30 and 31, not just 31. Verse 30, Isaiah 40. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. The word wait is our wait, kawah. It is a synonym for faith in the Old Testament. But they that wait upon the Lord, the sense is that they're under attention and they are waiting for something to happen. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. That's a nice thought. But listen to this one. They shall walk and not faint. What does that mean? What does it mean when he says they shall walk and not faint? Oh, that's one of the beauties of this verse. Walking is simply an allusion to the daily details of life. The grind. Not the high moments when you're all exhilarated and you run, but you're simply just walking through life. And the wear and the tear of life just wear you down until you want to faint. There's a certain excitement in ministry, men. And there's this engagement period when you're in your local church, and it's like a love relationship. It's the betrothal period, and everybody's lovey-dovey. Then we all get to know each other, and we know each other's weakness, and then we begin to plod and walk. And the pastor wears down and he faints. By the way, faith rest is not passivity. Faith rest means I commit to the Lord something I have no control over. If I have control over something and I have responsibility over something, faith means I act. We're going to find that out in the New Testament. I hope we have time to find that out. I'll make sure we do. Lord, I hope I'll try to make sure we do. Faith is not passive, is what I'm saying. While I'm waiting on the Lord, Isaiah 40, 31, I'm just waiting for him to move me. Maybe he's already given you the strength to move. Then move. I remember when I was in seminary, the most ridiculous thing I ever saw in my life. We had guys, you know, they were trying to mimic the maturity of the Apostle Paul. And we had a guy whose wife was pregnant. There she's carrying a baby. And they're starving. And I said to this guy didn't work. So I said to him, how are you getting along? Well, we're not doing too good. And I said, well, I know a place you can get a job, you know, if that would help. Oh, no. Don't you know the verse? They that preach the gospel shall live by the gospel. I said, yeah, I know the verse. I says, where are you preaching? You have some place that you minister persistently in? Well, no, I'm just going to school. I said, yeah, that's right. And you took the responsibility of having a wife and fathering a child? Well, I'm waiting on the Lord. I don't know, he might still be waiting. I know, I really don't know. You know what a lot of guys do in ministry? They feel sorry for themselves. They really do. I had a teacher. Her name was Bobby Edmondson. Did I tell you about this teacher last time I was here? She's an English teacher. English teachers are formed in the womb by God. They have all the same genes. They're nitpickers. They're wonderful nitpickers. Because, you know, if it was up to us guys, we wouldn't have any vocabulary. Grammar? Who cares? I learned to speak up there on the range, out there digging iron ore. I picked up my vocabulary from my buddies. Got at least 100 words, and 95 of them are curse words. That leaves me about 5 for my ministry. Yeah. That's right. When I got saved, God had to change my vocabulary. And my wife had to go in the hospital. Well, I was on the GI Bill. It wasn't enough. I didn't have any insurance. I had to pay the doctor. So I had to get a job. And so I didn't turn in an English paper. It was due. She was making us write. By the way, I've had wonderful English teachers. Most spiritual department I was in college were the English teachers, not the Bible department. And most of them were old maid women. And they were marvelous. They loved the Lord. They loved the Lord. So I didn't get this paper turned in. And so I went to class and she says, Ronald, now Miss Bobby, you know, nobody knows how old these English teachers are, you know, white hair, thin, looked like it'd blow away, you know, if a wind came along, and there it was down in Texas, the wind was blowing all the time, she probably carried lead in her purse to keep from blowing away. Ronald, you didn't turn your paper in yesterday. Would you please come to my office after class this morning, and we'll have to talk about this. Okay, so she goes on with class. So I go in her office, and I said, well, Miss Bobby, my wife had to go in the hospital, and I had to get a job, and, you know, I leave at such and such a time, and I go to work at 3 o'clock, and I don't get off till 11, and I get home about 12, and I have to get up about 6:30 to get down. I haven't been getting my... Yes, Ronald, that's the way it is, and that's the way it's probably going to be for the next years that you're here. Now, just settle down. That's what you got to do. Now, you get the paper in. In essence, she was saying, quit feeling sorry for yourself, you dope. It's your responsibility. You took it on. Now, do what you're supposed to do. And I wasn't any youngster now. Hear me. I was 24, 25 years old. I walked out early. And I went home and I wrote the paper out and I turned it in and she turned it back to me and she says, this was a very nice paper. F, late. You know why she did that? She had character. She had guts. And when it comes to the judgment seat of Christ, Miss Bobby's going to be up front, I'll tell you, because you should see what she had to put up with.
Why do I have to learn grammar? After all, I was raised out in West Texas. In West Texas, we don't care what you say, we just care how you say it. We froth it up out there.
And she had patience. That's okay. You have to learn grammar because you're going to try to communicate. You can't communicate without speaking. You have to speak in sentences. Plural subject takes a plural verb. You have to know what a verb is and direct object and so on. So she just had patience. How'd I get off on that rabbit? Oh, they that wait upon the Lord. Hear me. Faith rest is not passivity. The things that I can't control and have no responsibility for, and blessed is the man who knows where his responsibility begins and ends. The things I can't control, I faith rest with the Lord. I can't control your gossipy tongue. Your gossip is not my responsibility, but if I catch you, and I'm going to tell you about it. God hates gossip. God hates lying tongues. God hates a proud look. God hates mental attitude sins. I can't control a lot of things, but I can faith rest them. I can trust Him for the things I cannot control. I cannot control President Clinton and what he does. I cannot control the Congress who won't face up to the moral integrity and responsibility and have not enough character to balance the budget in the United States and save. Our nation economically. I can't control that. I can speak out against it. And certainly in my private life, I can faith rest it so I don't turn out to be an old sourpuss cynic. Looked like I was weaned on a dill pickle. And ate crabapple jelly for dinner and just choked down a persimmon. Did you ever notice Christians get caught up in conspiracy theories and they preach more about the conspiracy theory than they preach about the Lord Jesus Christ? And they're in doomsday all the time and then they say, but God is in control. Faith rest is not passivity. We're going to see that in the New Testament. But there are some things that we have to rest the Lord about. It's the things we can't control. Now note the simplicity of these Old Testament words for faith. Aman, to prop, support. Batak, trusting or thrusting oneself upon something as though to lie upon it in dependence. Yahal, to be weak, therefore dependent. Kasa, to flee to God and His word for refuge. Kawa, to wait patiently. God says in the Old Testament to the Hebrew people, this is how you will come to know me, and this is how you will grow, or one of the ways you will grow in your relationship with me. Now, when Habakkuk says, the just shall live by faith, he is establishing a divine principle. He is defining a dynamic. And it would be something like this, where God's speaking. I deal with men on the basis of established principle. Basic to the principle of perception or of seeing things is that it will be done by faith. And faith directed toward me is never, never misplaced faith. Now, I find it extremely interesting that we as human beings do live in a world where we place our faith in something, our trust in something, and often we find it is misplaced. I remember in the Operation Desert Storm, the intelligence reports that we had on the Iraqi forces in Kuwait, you remember this? It was reported they had 550,000 soldiers massed on the Kuwaiti border. That's a lot of men. And they operated in terms of all their strategic plans on how they were going to make the assault on the basis of the fact that there were 550,000 Kuwaitian soldiers there. In actuality, there was only 150,000, or even possibly 100,000 on the Kuwait-Iraq border. And yet we had confidence that there were more. It was wrong. We were wrong. I mentioned the balancing of the budget. I'm sorry, but this is something that really irks me. Really irks me. By the way, you've all seen the reports, aren't you, about Social Security? Right now, it takes 3.2 workers to support one person on Social Security. And it's projected, and that ratio is getting worse. It used to be that we had 10 workers supporting one person on Social Security. But there are so many people on Social Security, these roles are growing and growing and growing. You boys and girls, listen to this now. You know, teenagers say, what the heck do I care about Social Security? Well, you care if it comes time for you to get it and you can't get it, and you paid all your money in. The government is saying to you, we're going to take so much out of your check. Now, how much comes out of the check now? 15.2%. If you're self-employed, you pay 15.2% to the government for Social Security and Medicare. On top of that, you pay income tax. That's just for Social Security. And so, anyhow, they can project that Social Security is going to run out on such and such a date, because there's only going to be 2 workers for every person on Social Security, and that's not enough to support them. The ratio is out of balance. And that date is coming, I don't remember what it is, 2012 AD, something like that. Not 2012. There won't be enough workers. You know how many abortions we've had in the last 15 years? 35 million. Those babies that have been born have been part of the workforce by 2012, wouldn't they? There would have been a workforce. Now we have a president that says, I've got a budget that will balance in 5 years. And 66% of the cuts come in the fifth year when he's not in office. For those of you that are from Duluth, forgive me for repeating myself. You know what the President of the United States is asking when he tells you that? He says, would you believe me? Will you trust me? And I'm sitting on the other side of the boob tube, and my head is going, no. No. I wouldn't trust you as far as I could spit. You say, well, that's not spiritual. No, but it's reality. There is always that, what I'm trying to tell you is, there is always that which is vying for your faith and your trust. Now what God is saying is, trust in me and in my word is never misplace trust. I will never fail you. And he's saying it from the beginning of the Bible to the end of the Bible. It is a principle that transcends all dispensations, regardless of that in which you live. God wants you to trust him, not your money, not your scheming intelligence, not your cleverness. And God will create situations in which you will either look to him or something else to put your trust. All right. With that, let's move on to Habakkuk and continuation of the second answer of God to our good friend Habakkuk. In the remainder of this paragraph, we have five woes on the Chaldeans. And in your notes, I think this is page 3. I don't have the page numbers up here. We have a little slot here where we talk about the remainder of the chapter, the five woes on the Chaldeans. I want to go through those five woes as rapidly as I possibly can and try to finish this chapter. Let me continue reading in verse 5. He has said that the soul of this Chaldean and of anybody that fits this category, these categories of these five woes that follow. In other words, the woes are expressed in such a way that the Chaldean is primarily in focus, but they could go beyond him to anybody who uses these lifestyle attitudes that are expressed. His soul is lifted up with pride and hence is not upright in him. Verse 5, yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home. His home situation is not of any value to him. He is an inflated, egotistical person, and he enlarges his desire as hell. And the word for hell, of course, is the word Sheol, which means the place of departed spirits. He enlarges his desire as Sheol and is as death and cannot be satisfied. And the word picture is simply that as Sheol exists for the place of departed spirits and just waits for people to die and die and die so it can be expanded, so is this person's appetites in terms of the conquering of peoples. So it says in the last part of verse 5, but gathereth unto him all nations, all peoples, and heapeth up unto him all peoples. Shall not all these, that is the victim or the victim nations, take up a parable against him, and taunting proverb against them say, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. So that is the first woe. These are five woes. We'll just simply list them as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, number 1. 2 verses 5 through 8. And this is a condemnation about drunkenness. And inordinate greed. I'll simply put the word greed up here. Maybe it'll save some time. Verse 6, shall not all these take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb and say, woe to him that increases that which is not his. How long, and to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. What in the world does that mean? Well, it simply means thick clay were like bonds or loan pledges. They were what the government issues when it spends the Social Security funds. I wish I could get my mind away from that. I know I'm probably boring you to death. There's $20 billion excess in Social Security funds. It belonged to Social Security, didn't it? It should be drawing interest. The funds shouldn't run out. But what do? They take the $20 billion and they spend it in some budget thing supporting welfare or whatever. That's thievery. You couldn't do that. You'd be in jail. Dishonesty. There's no integrity. Now, Lord, help me not to refer to that again, please. That's exactly what this is. So what does the government do? They say, we've issued bonds. And these bonds will come due later on. Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. This person has issued these clay tablets, and that is an indication of a loan or a pledge of a debt. It's a form of promissory notes and usury. Shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee? The idea there is like you shake a debtor who owes you something, and he can't pay it back. And thou shalt be for booties unto them. Are you reading King James? What does that mean? Well, booties, that's not what you put on your feet in this case. That's simply a plural of booty, like a pirate would take. He would take booty, or he would loot the ship. And this is a plural form. It's an intensified form. Thou shalt be spoil unto them. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. Because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and all them that dwell them in. In other words, your day is coming, Chaldea. Now remember, God is telling Habakkuk this, that this is going to happen to those that punish Israel. That he has raised up to punish Israel. And for this to have any meaning for Habakkuk, he's going to have to take it by faith, right? Right. Okay. By the way, when God destroys Babylon, the place becomes desolate. You should write in your notes Isaiah 13, verses 19 through 22. I don't have time to look it up. For the destruction and the continuing desolation of Babylon. The ruins of Babylon are a witness to the law of retribution. Daniel records the fall of Babylon. Herodotus recounts it in his history. Isaiah prophesies it some 200 or 300 years before it happens. And even the Arabs will not pitch their tents where Babylon once was. Woe number 2. Verses 2. Chapter 2, verses 9 through 11. This speaks of the plunder that the Chaldeans effected, and it condemns them. Verse 9. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house. And you could translate it, woe unto him who obtains wickedly gain for his house. That is, he uses a wicked means because he's so covetous to make his house luxurious. Oh, you had such a beautiful illustration of this right here in Minnesota, didn't you? Was that here? Wasn't it a dentist that hired a crook to plunder homes? Wasn't that here? And they had furs and millions of dollars worth of whatever, that this crook had taken from homes. And they paid him some, they were like pawnbrokers, and they paid him some menial sum for these things, and then they were found out. That's the same thing. Look at what it says. Woe to him that covetous an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high. I'm going to build a house way up on the hill, on the mountain, that he may be delivered from the power of evil, to save himself from the hand of evil. He builds a fortification on a hill. God says it's not going to help him. Thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and hast sinned against thy soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. You're the very place where you live will condemn thee. And the picture here is of the Chaldean dynasty and empire. They plotted, they devised, they had cruel ambition, and God says, it's going to boomerang against you. They used slave labor to build these palaces, and God says, I'm going to bring it against you. Let's look at the next one, number 3. This is found in verses 12 through 14. So here, let me summarize this one, okay? I didn't do that. Number 2 is the plunder, the rapacity of the Chaldeans. Now remember, these are principles. Plan ahead. This is the way you plan ahead. The rapacity of the Chaldeans is condemned. Remember that these passages reach beyond the Chaldeans. They apply to any culture or any individual who seeks to live his lifestyle as these verses describe. Okay? Okay. Now the third woe intensifies the thought of building upon a foundation of injustice and cruelty. Verse 12. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood and establish a city by iniquity. Behold, it is not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall be weary, or the people shall weary themselves for vanity. And now if you have a marginal reference, I have Schofield. He says the verse should read, it is not of the Lord. It's not a question. And that would make it read this way. It is not of the Lord of hosts that people shall labor in the very fire, and people shall weary themselves for emptiness, futility, vanity. And this is the picture of those that in pursuit of material gain, they just about kill themselves, accruing to themselves things. You know, a typical picture of Southern California. Home with a 3-car garage, and you can't get the cars in the garage because in the garage there's a boat, and there's a wrecked vehicle. And outside the garage there are 3 cars because mom has to work, dad has to work, the kids have to work, and the house is in hock, and the cars are in hock, and they play the system to the hilt. And they're up to their ears in debt. And they did all this so they could have fun. So when they get home from work and they're all worked up, they have to hurry up to get somewhere so they can hurry up and have a good time. And when they get there, they hurry home. They're all nervous wrecks, and the details of life have thrown them a curve. This intensifies the thought of building lustfully and mainly on the basis of injustice and cruelty. Boy, I came across an illustration of this, and forgive me again for referring to the New East, but I thought this was something I didn't know, and I don't know if you know it. You know about Iraq and Saddam Hussein and the cruelty of that government. It is a dictatorship. There is a secret police. And whenever you have a situation like that and the ruler is threatened, there is always a purge. I think it was about a year and a half ago, you remember that Saddam Hussein's 2 sons-in-laws, who were very high in authority, left Iraq and fled to Jordan. And they had some bad things to say about their government that they fled from. But they left their wives back there, who were Saddam Hussein's daughters. And I don't remember the details of why they wanted to go back, but they got word back, and they said, if we come back, would we be forgiven? And Saddam says, oh, come on back, of course you're going to be forgiven. And they went back, and they were dead in about 4 days. Of course, they were murdered by the secret police, and Saddam could say, I didn't know anything about it. But it also meant that he had to purge the government, and so hundreds were assassinated. And one of the men who took two bullets was his oldest son. I think his name was Obu or something like that. Now, that oldest son sits today in a wheelchair, paralyzed by two bullets lodged in his spinal column. He is the victim of an attempted assassination, and the mystery of who remains, despite the concentrated efforts of Saddam's secret police. Hundreds have been questioned, hundreds more have been brutally killed in attempt to get an answer. But the most reasonable suspect is Saddam himself. Now listen to this. When Saddam's wife went to the hospital to visit her son, she told him that it really should have been Saddam who took the bullets. And what she didn't know was the room was wired. So now Saddam Hussein's wife sits in house arrest, as does his two daughters whose husbands were murdered. For when they were murdered, the daughters became violent against their father. There comes a time when people have had enough and they will turn on those who seek to rule despotically over them. And they have a right to do that, and they should. Now, our Lord is predicting to Habakkuk that this is going to happen. And now he does something that just blows you away. Let me read it without turning that over here. Look in the midst of this marvelous promise. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters that cover the sea. What in the world is that doing in the middle of that paragraph? For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. Now, five times you'll find the statement that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord. It's a prophetic statement. Isaiah chapter 9, write it down in your notes. They don't have time to turn to it. Tells us when this will happen. It will be, of course, in the millennial period. But there's only one passage that tells us that the glory of the Lord, that the knowledge of the glory of the Lord will fill the earth. Now, what is God's glory? His glory is His essence. His glory is who and what He is. As we sought to illustrate in our essence box last night and the night before. So in the midst of all this gloom and doom that is coming for any who live this kind of lifestyle, there is a rationale that says, there is coming a day that God's glory will fill this world as the waters cover the sea. Oh, what a thought. Oh, what a thought. That all the world will know the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. I love it at Christmas time when we hear Handel's Messiah. And they come to that great triumphant passage when Jesus Christ is recognized as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he shall reign forever and ever. Boys and girls, moms and dads, college people, God has determined sovereignly that his Son will be manifested to planet Earth in such a way that his glory will be shown totally, completely, so that no one will be ever able to miss it. And though the scene may be dark and the times depressing, and you're thrust into a lot of faith rest because you can't control the situation, you can set your course on the fact that there is a lighthouse ahead, and that lighthouse is the light of the glory of our God, which will one day accomplish what he says will come to pass. And Habakkuk's sitting in his tower. He says, I'm going to sit down in my tower, Lord, and I'm going to hear what you answer me. And God says, I'm answering you. I'm answering. So that passage takes this all and reaches it out into eschatology or end times, even from our point of view. The fourth woe. Again, drunkenness, debauchery. Not a good scene. Wow. Woe unto him, verse 15, that giveth his neighbor drink and putteth thy bottle to him, maketh him drunken also, that thou mayest look upon their nakedness. In other words, the debauchery, plying others with drink, so that there can be sexual orgies, etc. Thou art filled with shame, not for, but in the place of glory. Drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing, vomit, shall be on thy glory. For the violence of Lebanon, or the violence done unto Lebanon, shall cover thee. And the picture there is the almost the pillage of the geography, the trees of Lebanon. And the spoil of the beasts, which made them afraid because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land and of the city, and of all that dwell therein. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it? I skipped. I got beyond this one. Got to get that's part of the fifth one. Let me get that up there before we finish here. 18 and 19. Verse 14 has to do with drunkenness. Drunkenness. It has to do with sexual sins. Verse 18 and 19, or the fifth woe, has to do with idolatry. Notice there is a descending order in this. It keeps getting worse and worse. Sorcery and spiritism. Verse 18. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it? The molten image, and a teacher of lies, that the maker of his own work trusteth in. There is our word to have faith in. To make dumb idols. In other words, the one who makes the idol puts his trust in the idol. He worships them as gods. Woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. That's a form of sorcery and idolatry. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath in it at all, or at all in the midst of it. And now the climaxing verse. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth before him. Habakkuk? My second answer to you is, and I want you to write this down, I want you to make it clear, I want you to put it on tables, so that he that readeth may run and spread the message. This message is dependable. The time is not yet, but the time's coming when this is going to be fulfilled. You can depend on it. In the meantime, all my righteous people, all who are my own, all the redeemed, are going to have to exercise faith, rest in me. Now, I have a problem with these Chaldeans and anyone that lives this life still, and I'm going to pronounce five woes on them, which he does. So Habakkuk, that looks very judgmental, doesn't it? And it is. And it's going to happen. But Habakkuk, there is coming a day when the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. Trust me, it's going to happen. Now, in the meantime, I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I have not lost my way in history. I have not turned my back on my creation. I have not forgotten my chosen people, Israel. I am in my holy temple. I am not an absentee God. I will show my force in my time. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me, teenager. I won't fail you. My word won't fail you. Trust me. I am worthy of your trust. I am God. That's what he's telling us in Habakkuk. Tomorrow we're going to look at the statement, the just shall live by faith, and its implications in its context in the New Testament. Shall we pray? Our Father, as the supreme being of the universe, existing as spirit, we cannot see you. To see your supreme manifestation physically, we look at Jesus Christ. And beyond his physical being, we see your spiritual being empirically. But ultimately and finally, we must trust what you say about yourself, or we will not know you, because you have determined that they have come unto you must believe that you are, and that you are a rewarder of them that diligently seek you. You bless, you reward those that seek you. Now help every believer to sense the need and to find you faithful in this series, or to discover your faithfulness, or to discover some aspect of it that will help them personally wherever they are in their Christian experience, whether a teenager in high school or a college person or a young professional. Lord, I pray for these men that are studying for the ministry and how critical it is that they recognize their total dependence upon you, for who is sufficient for this marvelous message that you've entrusted us with. Our sufficiency is of Christ, and in him we lack nothing. Help us to know those truths, apply them. Help moms and dads and everyone in this fellowship to be stimulated to look more to you and to trust you for whatever thing is necessary in their life at this time. Discover it and trust you for it. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.